Mrs. Mead has asked me to emphasize the Mead Center, or the Wade Center. It's not the Mead Center yet. You have to be very wealthy before they name a center after you. She asked me to emphasize the center rather than emphasizing herself. However, she is the editor of Seven, an Anglo-American literary review that focuses on the seven Wade Center authors. And while some of the issues, such as the Dorothy L. Sayers Centenary issue, a center on a single author, I didn't know I was doing tongue twisters tonight, most issues touch on six or seven of the authors. And the topics range from symbolism in Chesterton's stories to the cricket match in Sayers' Murder Must Advertise. In addition to continuing responsibilities at Wheaton College, Mrs. Mead edited, with Clyde Kilby, the diaries of Lewis's brother, Warney, and with former Wade Collection director, Dr. Dorsett, who was our seventh lecturer. She collaborated with the Macmillan collection of C.S. Lewis's letters to children. And that collection was one of several books that show how tirelessly C.S. Lewis carried on a correspondence all across the world with all kinds of people. Some other of her publications are listed on the brochure. I told you that she wanted me to talk about the Wade Center, but I'm sure you would like me to let her speak for herself. Would you welcome Marjorie Lamp Mead? Thank you.
Good evening. It's good to be with you tonight. I'd like to begin by telling you a story. It happens to be a factual story, in other words, something that happened in real life, but it is a story nonetheless. This story begins nearly 40 years ago in the mid-1950s. A young man, then in high school, was living with his grandmother. His father had died in action during World War II, and his mother had been killed in a car accident when he was just 10. He had no brothers or sisters, though he was lonely for his mother and longed to have known his father. He was fortunate in that his grandmother was a loving woman who had made a good home for him. And so, in spite of the difficulties of his early years, this young man, his name was Phil, was still, by and large, happy. In particular, he found happiness in sports. He was a natural athlete, and he excelled in baseball and hockey. Then one day, when Phil was 15, he was struck down with polio. His case was very serious. The doctors could do little, and he ended up being paralyzed from the waist down. Suddenly, the one significant area in his life, which had been pure delight and which had brought him success, the area of sports, was denied him. He would never run, never skate, much less walk again. There was no hope of this ever changing. With cause, Phil was angry, bitter, blaming life in general for the tragedies which had filled his early years. Month after month, he lay there in the hospital, hardly moving, rarely speaking, quietly rebuffing any attempts to reach him. It was on one of these bleak days that his former English teacher came to see him. Few words were exchanged, and when the teacher left after a brief visit, he asked Phil, "Would you like anything to read?" Phil responded negatively. The teacher left. But on his next visit a few days later, the teacher returned with a copy of Huckleberry Finn. He left it on Phil's bedside table without a word. Now, Phil was doubly irritated by this gesture. Not only had he told the teacher he did not want anything to read, but he also most especially did not want a copy of Huckleberry Finn, a book they had read just the year before when he was a member of this teacher's English class. In fact, the more Phil thought about this book, the more he was angered. What was wrong with this teacher? What was the point? He knows I've read this book. Why did he bring it here? But for whatever reason, much to his own surprise, Phil found himself picking up this novel and beginning to read through the familiar pages. And before long, he was totally immersed in the story, enmeshed in a way which he had not been when he first read it just the year before. For in reading this once familiar story, as Phil later related to his doctor, I felt different. It's hard to say what I mean. I can't tell you. I can't explain what happened. I know that my mind changed after I read Huckleberry Finn. I couldn't get my mind off the book. I forgot about myself. Well, no, I didn't actually. But I joined up with Huck and Jim. We became a trio. Have you ever read a book that really made a difference to you? A book you couldn't get out of your mind? Now, I think we can all comprehend why a book like Huckleberry Finn can be so meaningful to someone in a situation like that confronting this young man. Since his paralysis had limited his opportunities and possibilities, or at least so he thought at the time, then to experience the world of Huck and Jim, to join in their travels, was a sweet privilege. The story had become the young man's legs. It enabled him to escape his environment, to go outside of himself. Perhaps. Certainly, there was an element of escapism in the sense that this young patient was released from the prison of his hospital room to wander the Mississippi River with Huck and Jim. But I believe the truth of what happened in this young life was deeper than this. I believe that the reading of Huckleberry Finn, the reading of story, was for this individual a window to reality rather than an escape from reality. Do you see the difference? Escapism means to avoid reality, to ignore the circumstances which surround us, to turn from difficult things to matters which fill us with pleasure for the moment, but do nothing to alter who we are or the realities of our lives. But in story, at its very best, we are challenged to look more deeply at even the smallest details of our daily lives. We experience events outside our own normal pattern. We are awakened to new understandings. We are taught new words. We are given new eyes. This deepening which story gives us can happen in simple ways, and indeed often through what we might consider simple stories. C.S. Lewis is well known as a writer of children's and fantasy stories, but he was also a devoted reader of both these genres throughout his life. Perhaps this may seem a bit odd to some of you. Why would an adult spend time reading fantastic fiction, or even worse, children's stories? But no doubt there are others here tonight who understand, for you share this taste in reading. Lewis, however, not only enjoyed these types of books, but he went so far as to say, "No book is really worth reading at the age of 10, which is not equally, and often far more, worth reading at the age of 50. Except, of course, books of information. The only imaginative works we ought to grow out of are those which would probably have been better not to have read at all. A mature palate will probably not care much for creme de menthe, but it ought still to enjoy bread and butter and honey." Now let me take a quick aside here, lest some of you panic and say, "I didn't like these types of stories as a child, and you're not going to talk me into liking them now, whatever you say." Fine. Converting you to the reading of children's and fantasy stories is not my purpose tonight. They simply happen to be the type of stories which lend themselves well to this discussion. If you would rather, please feel free to mentally substitute any other type of story you like. The same principle holds true. However, if you have never read Lewis's Narnia books, or J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, or A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh, among others, then perhaps you owe it to yourself to at least give them a try. You might be surprised and find you do like them after all. One of C.S. Lewis's favorite stories of this type was Kenneth Grahame's classic children's book, The Wind in the Willows. Do you know the story? It is the tale of talking animals, as Lewis would say, of loyal-hearted Mole and his good friend the water rat, of curmudgeonly but wise old Badger, and of the outrageously boastful but somehow still beguiling Toad. It is a book which celebrates the commonplace, cozy evenings spent drowsing by a glowing fire, the satisfaction of spring cleaning, and the even greater joys of escaping from work. It is also a story which delights in pastoral England of nearly a century ago, of boating on the river and a lazy picnic on the riverbank, of quiet walks in the countryside. It is a story of laughter and friendship, but also of nighttime bravery, of the routing of wrongdoers, and of courage among friends. It is a tale of life in the wildwood where nobility and adventure are as much a part of daily life as an afternoon cup of tea. Not only did C.S. Lewis find great enjoyment in the pages of this classic, he also believed that the reading of this story awakened him to universal basics. I'm quoting now from Lewis. It might be expected that such a book would unfit us for the harshness of reality and send us back to our daily lives unsettled and discontented. I do not find that it does so. The happiness which it presents to us is in fact full of the simplest and most attainable things: food, sleep, exercise, friendship, the face of nature, even, in a sense, religion. And in the same way, the whole story, paradoxically enough, strengthens our relish for real life. This excursion into the preposterous sends us back with renewed pleasure to the actual. Most of us here tonight do not face the type of horrendous physical and emotional challenge the young man lying paralyzed in his hospital bed experience. But we still live in a world which finds us frequently paralyzed by other means. All too often our world is one of high stress, overwork, days filled with occasional and for some prevalent tedium, of depression perhaps, and even fear. The simple pleasures and values which Lewis found in the pages of The Wind in the Willow often seem to be lacking in our lives and in the lives of those around us. See if you recognize in these words of Dorothy L. Sayers someone you know. Perhaps your roommate, your spouse, your elderly parent or your child, your friend or colleague, perhaps even yourself. And I quote from Sayers. In the list of those seven deadly sins which the church officially recognizes, there is the sin which is sometimes called sloth. It does not mean lack of hustle. It means the slow sapping of all faculties by indifference and by the sensation that life is pointless and meaningless and not worthwhile. It breaks down the standards by which we assess our spiritual values and causes us to look for satisfaction in the world. The next step is the sloth of mind and body, the emptiness of heart, which destroy energy and purpose and result in that general attitude to the universe which the jazz musicians aptly named the blues. Perhaps another word for the condition which Sayers is describing is spiritual malaise, a life filled with despair, despondency, and, to use her phrase, emptiness of heart. Characteristic of many in our day? Unfortunately, I think so. We live in a society of fraying values. People are overloaded with information, but information which often comes as a catalog of facts without any accompanying meaning. We listen with horror to the massacre of innocent 4- and 5-year-olds in the tiny town of Dunblane, Scotland, and we wonder, where in this world may we find a sanctuary from its violent madness? We are left longing for a restoration of a sense of beauty, truth, and spiritual value in our corporate life, if not our individual lives. And even those of us who have a real sense of spiritual grounding may still feel the need to have our faith strengthened and deepened. It is in this way that I believe story has the capacity to help us. Let me say at this point, I speak to you tonight as a Christian. And accordingly, the first place to which I would point you is to the Bible as a source of truth, but also as a work of literature. And literature which often expresses this truth through narrative or story. I would like to take a moment here to make certain that no one is confused about the very important issue of story and truth. You may have noticed when I began my talk this evening, I did not say that Phil's story was true, which it was, but rather I said that it was a factual story. I made this distinction for a reason. All good stories are true. Not all good stories are factual. Okay, you may be saying to yourself, you are describing the difference between fiction and nonfiction, right? Well, not exactly. I'm aiming at something deeper. Truth in story is not simply about facts, but it is about meaning, about insight, and about spiritual realities. Truth in story is about the transcendent and its presence in our ordinary circumstances, excuse me, and about our ability to perceive it. In other words, story, as it expresses truth, is a means to understanding ourselves and our circumstances in a new way. We read in 1 Corinthians 13:12, "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, but then I will know fully." Story in this sense offers us an opportunity to begin to know in a new way, to see through some of the dimness surrounding us. Indeed, story is one of God's good gifts to us. Thus, when I refer you to the Bible, I am simply pointing you to the foremost source for stories which can edify and strengthen, the most obvious of which are the parables of Jesus. But the parables are only the beginning. The Bible is full of stories, factual stories, yes, but stories nonetheless about human beings in their very specific, daily, personal human existence. It is important for us to reflect on the fact that the Bible is more than a series of commandments or instructions for life. God chose to make himself known to us through the stories of people. Individuals like Abraham, Joseph, King David in the Old Testament, Mary, John, Peter, and Paul in the New. Embodied in these stories is God's message to us. It is through story that he reinforces the truth which he wishes us to understand. In the church where I am a member, each Sunday it is traditional to have a children's as well as an adult sermon. For most of the time my family and I have been attending there, the children's sermon was didactic in nature, a brief object lesson with clear intent to instruct the children in a specific point. Several years ago, however, we called a new senior pastor. He approached the children's sermon in a totally new way. He used it as a time to tell stories from the Bible, from both the Old and New Testament. The difference in the response of the children was immediate and noticeable. Noisy, squirmy little ones were now quietly perched on the edge of their seats. They were listening, and more importantly, they were remembering. Furthermore, it was obvious that they looked forward to the unfolding saga, for as in the case with any good story, they simply wanted to know what happened next. However, the most intriguing response was not from the children, but rather from the adults in the congregation. It quickly became evident that each Sunday, when the children's sermon begins, it is not only the children that sit up a little taller so they might see the storyboard a little better. In fact, during the children's sermon, the sanctuary is as quiet as it gets the entire service. There is little shuffling of bulletins or creaking of pews from restless listeners. Rather, there is a sense of anticipation and enjoyment. Far from being bored with these familiar stories, the adults are just as engaged as the children. They, too, listen deeply and respond to the truth and strength of sheer story. But, of course, I am speaking tonight of more than only biblical stories. Earlier, I quoted from 1 Corinthians 13, where Paul compares our present condition of human awareness as seeing in a mirror dimly. English playwright George Bernard Shaw later used the same image to describe how art gives us clearer vision. And I quote, "You use a glass mirror to see your face. You use works of art to see your soul." Strong words, but ones that have been echoed throughout the years by many other voices. Voices which confidently declare that there is value in story. Value which is concrete and eternal and not merely ephemeral in nature. But it is one thing to say that works of art help us see our soul, and quite another thing to understand this concept. Indeed, it is fair for us to ask, how can this be? How is it that story has the ability to impact on us in a real way, to make a measurable difference in who we are and how we live our lives? First, story by its very nature is uniquely designed to touch us, to help us feel, to enable us to experience something new from the inside, to teach us things which we can learn no other way. When we want to understand others whose lives differ by time and circumstances from our own, there is no better way to learn than through story. Through story, we have the opportunity to be places we are forbidden in real life. Indeed, story has the unique power to allow us access to the inner heart and thoughts of others. Newbery Award-winning author Katherine Patterson terms this eavesdropping on a character's soul. I think this is a particularly apt description, eavesdropping. Even those people we know best, those individuals we live with on a daily basis, our parents, our roommates, our husband or wife, our children, they are not as accessible to us as the characters in a book. We are not enabled to know their thoughts, to understand their private motivations, to observe their every action. But when we read a story, this is exactly what we do. We live within the very mind of the characters. We see through their eyes, we hear with their ears, we feel with their emotions. In this way, when we read the legends of King Arthur and his knights, we learn a little bit about what it means to be noble, as well as what it means to be human and frail. When we read about the agonies of Heathcliff and Catherine, we join them on the desolate Yorkshire moor, and we too feel the fearfulness of love which has turned to hatred. When we see through the eyes of Dostoevsky's Alyosha, we learn about faith. Just as when we hear the tortured words of Lady Macbeth, we understand better the consuming power of guilt. The possible illustrations have no end. But perhaps you think it far-fetched that story can actually teach us to this degree. One small example. Several years ago, a friend and I were discussing the power of books. In this context, she told me about a good friend of hers, let's call her Anne, who had experienced an appalling childhood filled with neglect and abuse. However, Anne, who was now an adult, had become a loving and skilled wife and mother, and had created with her husband a home environment which was in stark contrast to the one in which she had been raised. Anne told my friend that when she was very young, she had read the book Little Women. And it was this book which served as her model for what family life should be. As she shaped her own home, Anne often used what she had learned from this story, just as we might recall the advice from a parent. Story can make a difference. Through the power of story, we begin to see outside ourselves and our own immediate world. But just as importantly, we begin to see within ourselves more clearly. For when we understand others better, we in turn understand ourselves. C.S. Lewis put it this way: each of us by nature sees the whole world from one point of view, with a perspective and a selectiveness peculiar to himself. But we want to see with other eyes, to imagine with other imaginations, to feel with other hearts, as well as with our own. We demand windows. Second, story can help us see things as they were originally meant to be. Note, this is very different from my first point, which was seeing things as they really are. In fact, good story does both these things. It helps us better understand the world we live in, just as it gives us glimpses of the world yet to come. Christian theology teaches us that we are living in a fallen world, which is very unlike the world God originally intended. Indeed, in Romans 8, Paul writes, I'm quoting now from Phillips' translation, "In my opinion, whatever we may have to go through now is less than nothing compared with the magnificent future God has planned for us. The whole creation is on tiptoe to see the wonderful sights of the sons of God coming into their own. The world of creation cannot as yet see reality, not because it chooses to be blind, but because in God's purpose it has been so limited. Yet it has been given hope. And the hope is that in the end, the whole of created life will be rescued from the tyranny of change and decay and have its share in that magnificent liberty which can only belong to the sons of God. It is plain to anyone with eyes to see that at the present time, all created life groans in a sort of universal travail." Other translations render this passage as all of creation groaning as if in childbirth. What a wonderful image, evoking the reality of this world waiting on tiptoe for its new birth. But even while this world awaits rebirth, it waits in the midst of change and decay. And as a result, we are often left with a sense of anticipation rather than fulfillment. Lewis names this anticipation of other things yet to come as joy or longing. It is a central theme in all that he writes, both fiction and nonfiction. He describes this longing as an unsatisfied desire, a searching for something which cannot as yet be found, a far-off country we are always seeking but never reaching, a hunger which is never quite filled. Do you know this feeling? Have you ever seen a sunset so beautiful that it almost hurt to look at it. Or listen to music so exquisite that it awakened a long dormant ache of wistfulness within you. Or to put it still another way, have you ever finally possessed something you thought you really wanted, only to find yourself even more dissatisfied than before? G.K. Chesterton called this painful and empty feeling as being homesick at home. Think about it. If this world is our home, then why are we so often filled with longing and dissatisfaction? What is it we are seeking? What is it that we long to possess that seems to so elude our grasp? Through story, not only are we awakened to this longing, to this need which is buried deep within us, but we are also given hints of the spiritual realities which surround us, yet are frequently hidden from our view. These numinous glimmerings amongst the ordinary are like the proverbial tip of the iceberg, and story is one way we have to uncover this deeper reality. Thus, story can help us to see the transcendent even in our finite daily circumstances. In fact, story is a means to point us to the ultimate and only source which can satisfy our deepest desires. Story can help to feed our spiritual hunger. I have chosen to concentrate tonight on just two of the ways in which story can make a difference in who we are, namely by helping us first to see ourselves and our world in a new way, and thus more clearly, and second, by opening our eyes to deeper spiritual reality in order that we might begin to see this world the way it was truly meant to be. But there are many other ways in which story can speak to us. A good story nourishes us by giving us the opportunity to create. When we read, we are required to use our imagination in a more dynamic way than is required when we watch a story on film. No matter how excellent a movie may be, we are a more passive participant in the creative process than we are when we read a story as it unfolds on the page. A good book engages our whole being, our imagination, as well as our minds. And it is this difference in imaginative effort which makes reading both more rigorous and more rewarding. Story has the capacity to nourish us by restoring a sense of beauty and truth to a world which is too often bereft of these qualities. We can find in story what we are missing elsewhere in our lives. A good story is also a conversion experience, not necessarily in a religious sense, though this has indeed happened many times, but rather in the sense that when we read a good story, we are changed. Or to put it another way, words that we have read, words that come to live in our hearts and minds, these words can and will make a lasting difference in our lives. Now, it is this very power of story to transform us for good or for bad which makes it so important that we choose the stories we read wisely. I am speaking now of our responsibility as readers. For whether we like it or not, whatever we read, we will be changed. And if story can impact us for good, it will also impact us for evil. Throughout this evening, I have used the term good story. By this, I do not mean only stories which have a happy ending, nor am I in any way restricting good story to mean an explicitly Christian story. I cannot emphasize this enough. Good story is much deeper, much broader, much richer, and much more encompassing than that. By good story, I mean rather a story that is well written, a story which has authenticity in its own artistic development. A good story does not manipulate the reader through such tricks as either false sentimentality or exaggerated brutality. Though a good story may certainly touch the reader through the use of either sentiment or savagery, but only if such means are true to the story itself and not simply imposed for false effect. A good story will certainly be entertaining, but it seeks to do more than simply divert our attention for several hours. It is the type of story which seeks, with integrity, to make a difference within us when we are done reading it. You may not, and indeed I would go so far as to say should not, agree with the ideas presented by every good story which you read. But interacting with story in this way, evaluating the author's worldview, understanding how it may differ from what you believe, and determining what you may learn from this difference, is a very significant part of our reading experience. Reading responsibly involves more than just our choice of reading matter. Responsible reading means reading alertly, taking time to reflect, and finally exercising the same sort of intellectual energy and discernment you bring to any important issue in your life. For it is only the educated imagination, as Northrop Frye terms it, which is able to properly examine what is being said. And the less rigorously we exercise our minds in this way, the less likely we are to be able to resist the lure of propaganda and to be able to discern truth from falsehood wherever we encounter it. So far, I have been speaking primarily of story from the point of view of the reader, but I would like to add one brief word about the responsibility of the author. A good story can only be written if the author is genuinely attempting to craft the very best story he or she is able to write, and not simply trying to use the story to manipulate the reader. In other words, the reader of a story cannot intend propaganda. The author's proper job is to write well and not simply to sprinkle about bits and pieces of worthy platitudes in hopes that the reader will pick some of it up. That sort of writing merely results in stale, unappetizing sermonizing, not in vibrant, exciting story. However, this obviously does not mean that the reader may not in fact be changed through reading the story. For though a story cannot make someone good or wise, it may still awaken such a desire within the person. But it's significant that we understand that any such change is the byproduct of good story, not the purpose. Though tonight I have been devoting most of my attention to the value of reading, it is equally important to remind ourselves of the rewards which books have for us as well. Stories are meant to delight. Reading is not medicine to be swallowed whether we like it or not. It is worth trying to find a book which you can enjoy and begin there. By all means, above all, read what you like. But don't stop there. Many things in our lives are acquired tastes, and books are no exception. Experiment and persevere. What at first seems bland or perhaps too spicy may in fact be just right when you only give it some time and some genuine effort. Like other skills, reading is an ability which requires work and exercise to develop properly. Nurture and nourish this aspect of your life, and you will reap great reward. I believe that story is one of God's good gifts to us. It helps us to understand ourselves and others better by opening our eyes so that we may, first of all, see things as they really are. Good story teaches us. It helps us to feel. It gives us opportunity to experience other realities. Indeed, story can be a signpost pointing us to the presence of God's truth in our everyday lives. But the reading of good story does more than this. Story can also help us find an answer to our emptiness of heart. It can be a means to satisfying the great longing in our soul, Through story, we can learn to see more deeply, to seek the spiritual realities hidden beneath the surface of our daily existence. For just the story helps us to see things as they really are, as well as to see things as they were meant to be. Story also shows us how things will be someday. In closing, hear these words of C.S. Lewis on the reality of story and what it foreshadows. If we take the imagery of Scripture seriously, if we believe that God will one day give us the morning star and cause us to put on the splendor of the sun, then we may surmise that both the ancient myths and the modern poetry, so false as history, may be very near the truth as prophecy. At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of the morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see, but all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we will get in. When human souls have become as perfect in voluntary obedience as the inanimate creation is in its lifeless obedience, then they will put on its glory, or rather that greater glory of which nature, and I might add story, is only the first sketch. This glory of which C.S. Lewis writes, we now hear only whispers of in nature, or catch the merest glimmers of in the pages of a story. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now we know only in part, but then we will know fully. And until that day, when our spiritual heart is fully awakened and our longing finds its true home, then story will serve both to feed our deepest hunger and to point us to the source of all our seeking. Thank you.